The summer before last, my former brother-in-law, who has remained relatively close to our extended family since his divorce from my sister back in, I think, the late 1970s, made what at the time seemed to be an odd request. He wanted some private time with each of the various family units, beginning with one daughter in California, another daughter in Michigan, my sister in Michigan, and with Carol and myself in Maryland. He had a confession to make. He had been drafted into the Vietnam War, I think out of graduate school. I don't recall the exact date. It doesn't matter. And as far as anyone knew in the family, including my sister, to whom he was married at the time, and their two daughters who were small children, he served in Fort Bragg and in the state of Hawaii. And I recall at the time that there was some mild joking about what a plush assignment he had. For as far as any of us knew, he never saw any actual combat. It turns out, however, that indeed he was in Hawaii, but that he was sent from there on a special and secret mission with some special unit that he was with to a mission in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam. And he was there for only about 2 weeks or a little bit more. His squadron walked into an ambush in a village that was apparently a stronghold of the enemy, and in the midst of heavy gunfire and explosions, he escaped into a small hut and found himself face to face with a young woman who was probably a teenager, who was holding a baby in her arms and a knife in her right hand. He hesitated a moment, and then he shot and killed both of them. For 45 years, he lived privately with the pain of that experience until, through extensive therapy, I think pushed by his third wife, he began to share it. And although there is now a partial understanding in the family of his episodes of depression so many years ago, including the destruction of a marriage that probably wasn't very good to begin with, the experience cuts much deeper. Like Michael Yandel, he was morally injured. In his own mind and in his own heart, he felt as though he had betrayed himself. Yet I think that there is much more to all of this than we are usually willing to admit. We have sanitized experiences like this with the psychological designation of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, as if to say that the problem is the inability of specific individuals to adjust and adapt to the harsh realities of the war experience and the violence that is inherent in it. After all, the argument goes, millions upon millions in all wars have seemingly adjusted just fine. I suspect that that is really not the case, however, if we're honest about it, and that it is simply more accurate to suggest that some people cope better than others. Some are better at suppressing the pain of the psyche than others. For war is hell. And there should be no shame whatsoever in feeling its pain and its pathos. Indeed, I would suggest that paradoxically, PTSD is a very profound signal that integrity and moral underpinnings are alive and clamoring to function at their fullest. And that the so-called disorder is like a fever pointing to an underlying disease, namely the dehumanizing of an enemy, and calling it, as Michael Yandel puts it, a quality of character. What we have called disorder is surely painful and needs to be treated, but it is fundamentally a sign of integrity not destroyed, of principle injured but not totally defeated, a sign of deep despair, but also of hope. The problem is that integrity and principle and hope will continue to be partially trapped, unable to function fully because of a much larger corporate system and mentality that beats them down at every turn. The problem is that moral injury is not simply a personal issue that manifests as PTSD, but is a corporate systemic problem that is deeply embedded in our culture and our world, and affects all of us because we are largely complicit in allowing it to occur in the first place. We have betrayed ourselves by allowing our leaders to sanction actions in the name of national security and patriotism that are clearly counter to what we stand for as a people. In 2003, while President Bush was announcing the liberation of Iraq on an aircraft carrier, what a farce that was, the media was showing images of Abu Ghraib to the rest of the world, where prisoners were being abused systematically. The late Susan Sontag, writing about the photos, described the efforts of low-ranking GIs to depict Iraqi prisoners as bestial, craven, dehumanized. She said, "We are high, they are low. We are clean, they are dirty. We are strong and brave, they are weak and cowardly. We are lordly, they are animals. We are God's chosen, they are estranged from everything divine." And Sontag goes on to say, "The photos are us." Nazis were not the only people to commit atrocities. Americans do so too, when they are led to believe that the people that they are torturing belong to an inferior, despicable race or religion. Now, to be fair, our leaders did do something about Abu Ghraib, but only when it was exposed by some of those who witnessed what was going on and had qualms of conscience and felt that they had to report it. But it turns out that Abu Ghraib was merely the tip of a much bigger iceberg. Enter the CIA and Cheney and company and psychologists and lawyers wanting to find ways to use enhanced interrogation techniques legally. In other words, by any other name, torture of prisoners in order to get information. Torture. Torture. It is not as if we have not known for a long time that torture occurs. But the released Senate Intelligence Committee's report, and you should read it, makes it abundantly clear. And esteemed members of the committee, both Democrat and Republican, have known for years. From every perspective, the depravity, the obscenity, the barbarism, the illegality has been clear. Waterboarding, rectal feeding, sleep deprivation, prolonged periods of cold and nakedness, hanging by wrists, in short, every defined crime against humanity imaginable, exercised in our name to supposedly protect us. The clear and flagrant violation of international protocols all over the place, outlined among other places in the Geneva Convention and operative as a sequel to the atrocities of Nazi Germany as prosecuted during the Nuremberg trials, has been on display as part of our collective war on terror. The New York Times has called for the prosecution of torturers and their bosses in editorials. And Obama, to his discredit, I think, has said we must look forward and not backward, as if one cannot do both at the same time. Have we not learned yet that to brush aside for any reason the history of the past means that we are virtually doomed to repeat it? He says that the torture techniques have stopped. I'm not so sure. He says that is not who we are. Unfortunately, to echo Susan Sontag, that is who we are, or at least who many of us are. And for many of us who are repulsed by policies and acts that are reprehensible, we are morally injured. We want to be healed, but healing cannot take place unless and until there is some kind of accountability. There is now the very tired argument of efficacy regarding the so-called war on terror. This is basically Cheney's stance. We may not like torture, but it is effective. It's necessary because it works. The minor difficulty with that argument is that the evidence seems to indicate conclusively that it doesn't work. The major argument, however, against it is that it is morally injurious, not to the enemy, but to us. It violates who many of us say we are. And are we not the persons who need to do something about it? It has occurred to me as I have struggled with this sermon, and believe me, I have struggled with it, that we live in a culture where many of us are so inured of violence that it really doesn't matter one way or the other. Just as so many are inured to bigotry and Islamophobia that they don't want to be confronted by it. There are, and I think they are probably in the majority, people in the middle ground, some of my very beloved friends, who say, yeah, it's all pretty bad, but there isn't really anything you can do about it. It's the way we are. It has official sanction. Our politicians are not about to change. And finally, there are those, and I hope there are many among us, who take talk about the inherent worth and dignity of all people seriously, who look at relationships on a personal and a corporate level as requiring compassion and justice and equity. People who really do believe in a world community where there is peace and justice and liberty, who believe that achieving these goals requires means that live up to our ethical standards, and that to use unethical means to accomplish good ends or even noble ends causes moral injury. And this is what those who use the efficacy argument don't seem to understand, that destroying the soul of a people to provide supposed security is metaphorical death. We acknowledge now the 70th anniversary of Auschwitz. And documentary after documentary reveals again the horrific nature of the Holocaust. But what has struck me in those documentaries, maybe more than anything else, is the way in which the acquiescence of so many people to the atrocities going on in their midst. The trite phrase, to go along, to get along, hardly captures the irresponsibility of relative silence in the face of the greatest evil of modern time. My confession now is that this is perhaps the most depressing sermon that I have ever preached in my life. And by my calculation, I've preached maybe 2,000 or 2,500 times in my career. So it's a lot. I said in the introduction to this service that it would be X-rated emotionally. And I have to say, it has been X-rated for me. It has been a draining experience to write this sermon and now to preach it for the second time. But I cannot be content to leave myself and you in a state of moral injury. So being the provocateur that I am sometimes, let me try to suggest a way forward. First, we need to break the relative silence on this issue. Here at UUCF, where I am embarrassed to say we really haven't talked about this that I'm aware of very much, we need to talk about it with groups with whom we are affiliated. Indeed, I would like to build a movement. I don't know if that's possible. Secondly, in the larger court of human opinion, it needs to be made clear that much of what our officials have done since 9/11 we consider to be immoral, counterproductive, and injurious to many of us, if not all of us, in a larger sense, whether we realize it or not. And in this regard, it is perhaps not useful or even prudent, in spite of the call by the New York Times, to seek prosecution of those who have broken the law. Rather, I think we might find ways to struggle at one and the same time to expose more fully the far-reaching dimensions of the wrongs committed in our name, but then grant forgiveness to all, including ourselves, whether Cheney and company want it or not, or whether we want it or not. I know that millions around the world were deeply moved and inspired by what Desmond Tutu accomplished in South Africa with the amnesty program. It seems to me a model worth adapting in creative and imaginative ways. I'm not exactly sure how that might be done, but I would like to try it. It could be, it seems to me, a way of saying, never again, never again, but also a way of saying, we're starting afresh to try once more to get it right. To get it right. Third, we must never lose sight of the larger picture within which moral injury is set. I have been reading Karen Armstrong's book, Fields of Blood. It is brilliant. It is difficult. It is overpowering. It is not an easy read emotionally. I recommend it highly. She says at the end of her tour de force, When we confront the violence of our time, it is natural to harden our hearts to global pain and deprivation that makes us feel so uncomfortable and depressed and frustrated. Yet we must find ways of contemplating these depressing facts of modern life, or we will end up losing the best part of our humanity. Somehow we need to find ways of doing what religion at its best has done for centuries: build a sense of global community, cultivate a sense of reverence and equanimity for all, and take responsibility for all of the suffering in the world. So may it be. So may it be. Amen.